your words should be motivating and they should be supportive and they should be encouraging, not the opposite. I noticed that with family and friends coming to visit me that I couldn't handle negative people around me, the ones that would come and sort of look at you like you were half dead or already dead. I felt like I didn't need people like that in the room. I needed people who were going to say, we're going to find a way, I'm going to support you, we're going to help you, we're going to get through this.
How can experiencing a stroke trigger massive post-traumatic personal growth and be the best thing that ever happened to you? Let's talk all about it with author, podcaster, stroke survivor, and stroke recovery coach Bill Gassiamus right here on episode 469 of The Nurse Keith Show. Hey there, this is Nurse Keith. This podcast, of course, is always about you, your personal and professional development, your career, and the healthcare system writ large. And I'm here to share education, ideas, diatribes, and informative interviews with some of the most inspiring people from the worlds of healthcare, nursing, entrepreneurship, medicine, and beyond. I love having you along for the ride, and I thank you from the bottom of my nurse podcaster's heart, the very, very bottom, for being part of the growing Nurse Keith Nation. If you want to help other people find the show, I'm always asking people to leave a rating and review over on Apple Podcasts. That's super helpful. And just share the show with anyone who you think might enjoy it. And if you want to become a patron, head over to Patreon, patreon.com/Nurse Keith. As little as $2 a month is a great way to show your support for the show and keep the lights and the cameras and the microphones rolling over here. Actually, there's no cameras, but that's okay. So anyway, that's patreon.com/Nurse Keith. I appreciate you all so very, very much. And you can head to nursekeith.com to find the show notes for this episode in the menu labeled podcasts. And the show notes and all the links that will be mentioned in this episode will be in any app where you find yourself listening. And like I said, we're here today with Bill Gassiamus. He is a stroke survivor who became an author and a podcaster and a stroke recovery coach. And Bill, there's so much to talk about, including your awesome book that I just finished. And the first question I want to ask you is, paint a picture of for us what it was like for you in terms of your life before the stroke. What were you like? What was the trajectory of your life?
G'day, Keith. My life was pretty standard. Two kids at school, mortgage, car repayments, the whole box and dice. And I was an entrepreneur. I started a business in my late 20s, which is to paint people's homes and properties wherever they were. And I was so consumed with that kind of work that I found myself doing probably anywhere between 12 and 16 hours a day. So my day would start very early. Around 6:30 in the morning is when the alarm would go off. I'd be at work on site around 7:30, getting everyone ready, getting everyone going on the job. And then my task would be to either help them on site or to attend another quote or to pick up materials and bring them back. And that went on for quite a number of years, and it was starting to become a real drag. It was a real pain because it was very difficult doing all those things, having that many hours of work every day, and then also being a dad of two children, young children. And it wasn't much fun. When I reflect on it, we had fun times and we spent time with the children and we did a whole bunch of stuff that you would expect a family to do together. We interacted with our other extended family. We went away from time to time, but day to day was really just about work. And I didn't have a lot of time to myself. I didn't have anything that I could do to unwind. I smoked. I drank, not excessively, but I drank. I probably didn't sleep properly. So it was the standard Australian lifestyle for a period of time, and probably familiar to a lot of people in the United States.
Mm-hmm. And then one day, according to the story in your book that you tell so very, very eloquently, you started having some symptoms and it started kind of small. And what I got from the book is that you had a lot of denial running. And you didn't really want to deal with it very much. So what was going through your mind as these symptoms, you know, on the one side of your body just started to get a little more and a little more and a little more, and you were kind of pushing back against this reality that was facing you? What happened in those, what was going on in Bill's head at that time?
We have an ad that runs in Australia, or used to run back in the day. It was for a product called Codral, cold and flu tablets. You take them, and then the jingle goes, "Soldier on with Codral, soldier on." So the idea was really well embedded in my head. It was soldier on. It was just go to work. The numbness that I noticed was in my big left toe, and it was just a small amount. It was enough to sort of say, oh, that feels weird, but that's about it. And then that was a Friday morning. I put my socks on, shoes, went to work. No second thought to that particular issue. But the following Sunday, which was my day at the gym running on the treadmill, I noticed that the numbness had spread to the top of the ankle. And at that time, I couldn't run on the treadmill because I had to focus on where my foot was landing instead of get into my routine and my rhythm and do my 25 minutes on the treadmill. And even then, it was kind of like, well, that's weird. My legs shouldn't be doing that, but I got through my 5 kilometers. It's all good. And the next morning when I woke up and went to work on the Monday, so now probably the fourth day after noticing the numb toe, the numbness had spread to about my knee. And we had a really big week coming up. So we had two jobs going. One was in the preparation stage, one was in the finishing stage, and I was between the both of them. And I was keeping clients happy everywhere. And I just needed to get the job that we were finishing done so we can attend to this other job at the end of the week, which was a massive job. And it was going to be 12 hours solid, and it was probably 15 guys relying on me to be there, start it, run it, finish it all in one day. The client hadn't given us any other window of opportunity to get it done. So I was extremely focused on not letting everybody else down. So when the numbness spread to about my knee that Monday, I rang the chiropractor. I made an appointment to see the chiropractor. He's responsible for all of the fixing Bill things that you do when you go to work and you don't pay attention to your body and you mess things up. You go to Dale and Dale fixes everything. And I went to Dale and Dale said, listen, there's something strange happening. I can't tell what it is quite yet. It's probably inflammation. Take some anti-inflammatory medication. And if you notice it's getting worse, get in touch and we'll look at it again. Now, I'd been seeing Dale for about 12 years by then. You know, we knew each other intimately. So I ignored the symptoms for another 2 days. And by Wednesday, my wife even noticed I was walking strange. And I made another appointment to see the chiropractor. On the Wednesday, when I rang, the only appointment available that was going to suit me was Friday late in the afternoon after work. So by the time I got to his office on Friday, the numbness had spread to the entire left side of my body. So my entire left side was numb, like you had been sitting on your leg and you get the tingling feeling. That was how the entire left side was. I went to the chiropractor. He said, whatever's happening to you is not your spine or your back or anything like that. You need to go to the hospital. And I said to him, well, I'm going to work tomorrow. If I go to the hospital.
You still do want to go.
I have to, because if I go to the hospital, they'll keep me in over the weekend and I won't be able to go to work.
That's what you told your wife, right?
I told her that as well. When I went home instead of the hospital that Friday, after Dale said to go to the hospital, Christine said, why are you home? Let me take you to the hospital. I said, no, I've got to get to work. And then she said, look, why don't I take you to the hospital? They'll scan your head. They'll tell you there's nothing wrong. And then you can go to work tomorrow. And I thought that was a great idea. It's exactly what we did. But of course, when we got there and I said to them, I can't feel my left side, they rolled out the red carpet straight into the CT scanner. And then, they picked up a bleed on the brain. Mm-hmm. And they reported that to me at about 11:30 p.m. that evening, Friday, a week after I first noticed the first symptom.
Oh my gosh. And what I understand is that you had AVM, arteriovenous malformation, right? And correct. that can be extremely deadly, right? When that opens up, that, I mean, that doesn't necessarily have to be a slow bleed, does it?
It doesn't. Unfortunately, I've interviewed people on my podcast who've lost children at the age of 5 to AVMs.
Ooh.
I've found amongst my guests a lot of people that have experienced an AVM and are experiencing far more physical deficits than I experienced, and a lot more neurological issues as a result of it. So it can be catastrophic and it can be deadly. And then it can have... And then either way, it's serious. So whether the bleed is little or slow or whatever you want to call it, it's still a bleed in the brain. So it's still very dramatic.
Mm-hmm. And you're so lucky, because I was reading your book and reading how you just kept putting it off and kept putting it off. And you're trying to get up a ladder and you couldn't quite, you know, your foot wasn't quite working on the ladder. And I'm reading your book saying, Bill, go to the hospital, go to the hospital.
Yeah.
Of course, because I'm a nurse. But you survived, you had surgeries, and you did have other bleeds. This wasn't the only one. You had a series of three, I believe, and then surgery, mm-hmm. right? So you had to really focus on your recovery, even you were a very, very hardworking man. So what was it like for you to have to enter into this process of recovery and disability, even if temporary, when you were used to being a man on the go and a father on the go and a husband and all the other things that come with that?
It's pretty terrifying. The challenge is that most of us, and including me, are very limited in the way that we build our identity. So I had built my identity as a father who goes to work, makes money, pays the bills, and does everything on his own and doesn't get help and doesn't say no and just keeps going and going. And then I've gone into hospital. I spent 7 days there. And I was told after I was sent home, I was told no work for the next 6 weeks, which meant that I went from being busy for 16 hours a day to having nothing to do. And that makes you think about things and it plays on your mind and it makes you question everything that's going on in your life. And because I was still upright and they had given me a prescription of dexamethasone, mm-hmm. I wasn't feeling the left side deficits anymore. They had gone, but I was experiencing the dexamethasone, what do they do? They cause side effects.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really difficult because I went from being a very fit, healthy, in my mind, fit and healthy person to somebody who now, because of the dexamethasone, was putting on weight. I put on about 8 kilos in 2 weeks. I think that's almost double in pounds.
Mm-hmm.
And then I noticed that I wasn't sleeping. I wasn't able to, I was hallucinating. I could feel my skin crawling. So I'm a completely different person, literally within 7 days of after being released from hospital, and I don't know myself. And then I'm getting angry and I'm hungry all the time. And it was just not me. It was not me. It was just a completely different person. And I couldn't comprehend it. So much so that at around the 6 week mark, I was bored at home and I figured I'm going to go to work. So I called a few of my work colleagues to come and pick me up and take me to work. And I went to work for this one day. It was almost time for my 6 week appointment, maybe 2 days before my 6 week appointment. And I go to work and I said to them, I'm not allowed to work, so I'm going to watch you guys work. And they were painting this massive wall. It was probably about 4 meters high, and it would have been about 10 meters wide. And I was sitting on a chair in the middle of this room in a hotel, and I'm watching them paint this wall. And then I start to notice my left side going limp again, and then the numbness kicking in again, and then the room spinning and feeling nausea and feeling like I'm going to vomit. And I thought, well, I've got to get out of here, but I don't want to rush them from the job. I want them to finish the job before we leave from here, because the client is going to need to be happy with the result and pay us. So it didn't matter like how much I was told that I was unwell and sick, I still couldn't break away from that identity, which was go and just get the job done no matter what. And then when I ended up in hospital after the second bleed, I found myself in a completely different situation where I couldn't finish sentences. I couldn't type an email. I couldn't remember who visited me. At one point, I didn't know who my wife was. I couldn't announce myself at hospital. I didn't have the words or the capability of actually saying, my name's Bill, I'm feeling unwell, etc. I got none of that out. So it was just a horrific case of identity theft is the best way to describe it.
That's a very powerful term to use to describe it, identity theft. And I bet, you know, most of my listeners are nurses. I bet some of them have probably had strokes or heart attacks or been sick themselves. And nurses often say, many of us make the worst possible patients, though we love taking care of patients, but we're not very good at being on the other end of the stethoscope. So what I gathered from your book, and you have stories, you know, interviews you've done with, I think it's 10 different stroke survivors in the course of the book.
Nine other stroke survivors.
What I got from you was that language, mindset, and other aspects of how you approach your recovery mattered more than anything. I mean, of course, your medical care mattered, right? You need to trust your medical team and follow orders and take medications and get your scans. But what did you discover about mindset and about the power of language and thought that you feel like really did the trick for you? And was that like a lightning strike, or is it something you had to work on over time and get there?
I would say that if you met me before the stroke, I was a pretty outwardly positive guy, but it was a facade. Mm-hmm. Internally, I used to run a negative mindset, and it was everything's too hard. You know, everyone's against me. I can't get anything done. I can't prosper. I can't do this. I can't do that. And I realized that if I took that type of mindset to my recovery, it was going to be a tough time. I wasn't going to be able to manage. And what kind of example would I be setting to my children who at some stage in their life will experience some ill health? And I felt like I needed to make some changes. And it happened very dramatically because I was waiting for doctors initially to solve my problems. I said, you know, I had outsourced it to my chiropractor previously. I outsourced all my solutions to the doctors. And they did their job fantastically. However, it wasn't up to them to teach me how to have a positive mindset or to have hope or to look for solutions instead of focusing on problems. So I did have a very quick shift in the way that I was approaching the deficits that I was experiencing, especially when I was getting emotional and getting upset and crying. And then going on to the other side of the spectrum and getting angry and being abusive. So one of the first things I started to do was started to apologize, which is not something I had ever done before in my life, really done. So I started to apologize to my wife when I'd misbehave, and I'd say, look, I'm sorry for behaving this way. I don't know why I did. Something's going on in my head. It's messed me up, et cetera. And she accepted graciously the apology every time that it came after the multiple, you know, bad behaviors. And then what I also did was I noticed that certain words that people said to me didn't resonate. So some doctors would come and say some words that I didn't feel were appropriate in the way that I wanted to be treated about the recovery. So you're the doctor, I've outsourced my health to you to an extent. Your words should be motivating and they should be supportive and they should be encouraging, not the opposite. I noticed it with family and friends coming to visit me that I couldn't handle negative people around me. The ones that would come and sort of look at you like you were half dead or already dead. I felt like I didn't need people like that in the room. I needed people who were going to say, we're going to find a way. I'm going to support you. We're going to help you. We're going to get through this. So it was a real dramatic shift for me. And I very carefully curated the kind of conversations that I was having with people and how I was going to go about who I was going to allow into those conversations. And I was very careful to not say certain things to certain people because I didn't want them to have the wrong response.
Very interesting. So I like this concept of curating who you have around you, curating the conversations. And if you're in the process of recovering from something so life-threatening and life-changing, you obviously want to exercise a lot of control over factors in your life that you can control, because obviously a lot of things had been outside of your control, like having ABM and 3 bleeds and brain surgery. It's not something you would have chosen for yourself, even though your book says that it's the best thing that ever happened to you, which is where you got to through this process. But I'm interested, you mentioned in the book something I'm familiar with, which is the power of the word yet. And my fiance has actually taught me this. So can you explain what that's all about?
I used to say, I'm never going to get that particular job, or why would they ever consider me, or I'm never going to be able to run a successful business from my backyard, or all those things. I used to have all these negative ways of describing my life, and I used to fulfill those negative outcomes 100% of the time. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize that I was partly responsible, because I used to set the goal in the negative and I used to accomplish it. And I had this amazing coach. After I became unwell, I decided that I needed some support beyond medical interventions. And I went and sought out a life coach, and this particular lady, Louise Gilbert, she's my friend now. And she spoke to me about the work of Carol Dweck, where Carol Dweck talks about the growth mindset and a fixed mindset, but also importantly talks about the word yet and the power of adding the word yet to a sentence like, I can't walk yet. Mm-hmm. I can't walk is true and correct right now for the time being. Yet automatically shifts the feeling of that word from right now to the future, in the future, that is possible for you to walk in some way, shape, or form. And the yet just says you can't do it right now. And adding the word yet to sentences like, I can't walk, or I can't use my arm, or all those things that were a fact in that time, in that moment when I was unwell, just shifted it, the focus immediately away from that time to a future focus, where without knowing it at the beginning, I didn't understand what I was doing. It just felt better. Without knowing it, what I'm doing is activating my reticular activating system to look for solutions to problems like I can't walk, and sort of place it into the future where there would be a change. Now, I don't know what the change looked like. I just knew that there was going to be a change for the positive.
Mm-hmm. And this was new for you. So you had to learn new skills. Not only were you navigating the medical system where you didn't really want to be, because you would rather have been working and hanging out with your kids and living your life like you always had, but you also had to relearn how to approach your very way of being, your way of thinking, your way of moving in the world and thinking about your life. And that's not a small thing. And I know that now, through your podcast and through your stroke recovery community, you help other people do the same. And you have created a little universe around you where people who are recovering from stroke can come, get support, learn these skills, and have just get support around making these types of changes in their own lives and sharing their stories with other people. And I think that's a really powerful thing. And your book is a really great resource, as is your podcast and your website. So when we come back from the break, I'd love to have you read a little passage from your book. And then I want to talk about some of the things you found important, like neuroplasticity, sleep, nutrition, all the things that have added up to you being where you are today. Does that sound okay?
Fabulous.
All right. So hang in there with us. We'll be right back with Bill Gassiamus right here on episode 469 of The Nurse Keith Show. Welcome back to the second half of the episode. We're here again with friend of the pod and my new friend and colleague, Bill Gassiamus. And Bill, it's so good to have you here. And your book is really wonderful. And it's called The Unexpected Way That a Stroke Became the Best Thing That Happened. And it's very inspiring. And of course, you tell your story about the numb big toe and sort of the how things continued to devolve and evolve from there. And then you have interviews and stories from 9 other stroke survivors. And could you do us the honor of reading a little passage from the book for us? I just love for listeners to hear parts of a author's book in their own voice, because I think that's so important.
Yeah, thank you. I would love to do that. So in the introduction, there's a heading that goes, "What I want for you and your life." And it goes, "When I started my recovery from stroke in February 2012, it was hard to find information on an integrative recovery from stroke, trying new things to support recovery that lacked scientific evidence was frowned upon by most Western doctors. What that did, and rightly so in some instances, was make survivors second guess potential supportive therapies and rely only on the medical community for solutions to stroke, most of whom, thankfully, have not had a stroke. When the gaps in stroke recovery and support emerge, many survivors of stroke feel as if there is nothing else that can help and hope may be lost. Along with the podcast, this book is one small step towards decreasing the size of the gap which exists in stroke recovery. In each chapter, I have referenced as few sources as possible, citing only the best one or two that support the idea behind the chapter. I do not overcomplicate it with scientific publications, and so this book remains an easy read. As a stroke survivor myself, overcomplicated publications, which were jam-packed with information, made it difficult for me to track my progress. This meant that I would easily lose hope. I would easily lose the motivation to read on, which led to potentially helpful books being put down and placed out of sight where I would forget about them. Although that eased my brain from the burden of thinking too much, it may have made my recovery harder. I want this book to be the one that you read all the way to the end."
It's really, that's great. That's wonderful. And I think that's a great goal and a great message to your readers. And I'm curious, you mention in the book the many concepts. We can't talk about all of them. We don't have enough time. But I wanted to mention the concept of post-traumatic growth. So what did you learn about post-traumatic growth? Had you heard about it before? And how do you perceive its role when you've been through something so life-changing and, in your case, life-threatening?
I hadn't heard about it before. I didn't even know it was a thing. Mm-hmm. What happened was, I think I randomly came across the actual concept on the internet. I think it might have been Marty Seligman or someone along those lines who was speaking about the concept. And I had always heard of post-traumatic stress disorder. And I didn't want to be in a situation where I had found myself traumatized for the rest of my life by something that had happened to me because of a stroke. So I had done a lot of the counseling probably for about before the stroke happened. I think I was in counseling for about maybe around a decade. Now, there could be a little bit off there with the number, but roughly about a decade. And I had dealt with a lot of the stuff that I had built up over the years in my life, and I had put everything to rest, so to speak. I had dealt with it. I had got it off my chest. I had come to terms with it. So when I was in stroke recovery, I was just dealing with stroke recovery. So the fact that I didn't have to deal with all my past, we'll call them traumas, and I was just dealing with stroke recovery, really opened up the landscape for just growth, because I wasn't getting rid of stuff. I was looking for stuff to build on, to bring in. And when I started to discover, for example, what nutrition could do for the healing brain, it was a game changer. I was given a task by my new friend and coach, Louise, to stop drinking sodas, for example. And she would not work with me unless I stopped drinking sodas. And I thought, you bitch, I'm paying you money. You work with me. It's as simple as that. But she refused to. So what I didn't realize was that one request for me to stop drinking sodas before I worked with Louise meant that I was able to then investigate the rest of my diet and pay attention to what I was eating that was not serving me and take that out of my diet. And when I did that, as I did that, I started to feel better. The fatigue in my head from the stroke started to decrease. I started to have more energy. I started to able to interact with my world more. I was able to be there as a father more for my children. I was able to slightly get back to work and take on some of those tasks that have been waiting around in the background. And I started to get excited about the possibility that I can affect positive change on how I feel and get massive results by doing something as simple as just stopping the consumption of sodas. And I didn't know that I was experiencing post-traumatic growth or going through a post-traumatic growth cycle, but I just loved that idea that I've done this thing on my own and I'm getting such massive results and I'm having a positive impact on my stroke, that then it was okay, where else can I take action that doesn't cost me anything that I can have a positive outcome from? And one of those places was from neuroplasticity. It was the most amazing thing when I learned about neuroplasticity. It was through listening to a talk at the Florey Institute, which is a brain institute here in Melbourne. It's associated with the Melbourne University. And there was a gentleman speaking there, Mike Merzenich. And Mike Merzenich is the godfather of neuroplasticity. And I went and listened to this particular presentation, and I started to learn about what neuroplasticity can do in recovery. And I remembered three years later when I was recovering from brain surgery, I remembered the presentation that Mike Merzenich did. And he spoke about a part of the brain that lights up and creates new neuronal connections simply by meditating on that particular task that you want to recover. So I couldn't walk when I woke up from brain surgery. I had to learn how to walk again. And I had 3-day lag between brain surgery and then actually being in therapy to learn how to walk again. And I was using my brain to imagine myself walking and knew that as I was doing that, I was firing off all the neurological pathways that I was going to need to recruit when I actually started walking. And I gave myself a three-day head start. And I just felt amazing again that I was able to impact my life in such a positive way, cost me nothing from my hospital bed just by closing my eyes and imagining myself doing something that I deeply wanted to do. So it just stemmed from there. That was my second major massive thing that I would sort of reflect on when we're talking about post-traumatic growth. But of course, in there was many, many others.
Yeah. And what I get is that you also found, well, first, I just want to take a step back that it is true for many of us, when we make one small change, like you make a small change to your diet, you do start to think, oh, what else can I do? And one thing just sort of opens the door to the next thing. So what I gather from you too is that sleep and exercise also began to figure largely, that if you're eating well, of course you want to take care of your body. So of course you want to get sleep and you want to exercise. So were those also, did those come into play very quickly as soon as these changes started to kind of come to the fore?
Yes, sleep was intermittent. So sometimes I used to sleep well and I remember feeling really well that next day and having a lot of energy to do things. And then sometimes I remember people saying, well, we've got a function, you know, come to a party and we'll go to the party. And I'd be say I was enjoying myself at the party for too long, and then we went home at 1 a.m. and then I got home the next day, and then I'd need 2 days to recover. Mm. I really quickly realized that that one or two extra hours at the party, because I was having a good time, meant 2 days of suffering. So I needed to really dial in my sleep. And I've even have posts on my Instagram account that says, you know, I had a rest today, did nothing, and felt in my mind, felt guilty about it. But I really know that I'm doing good things to actually heal my brain and recharge my batteries and allow me to be good tomorrow. So I had to overcome that whole sleep when you're dead type of routine. And that meant that I was less cranky. I was able to solve more problems. I was able to be more creative. I was able to communicate better. My speech would be better in those really tough days where I couldn't remember the sentences and finish a sentence. And my memory would be better. And everything about it was going to be better. So I made a big effort to make sure that I was in bed as early as I needed to be, slept for as long as I needed to be. And sometimes I would even duck out when I was at work. I would even duck out into the car, have a little sleep in the car park for about 20 minutes and recharge the batteries and then get back to work and keep going. So I made it a priority, and I didn't allow people to sort of influence me to stay out for a little bit longer because we were having a good time. And then with exercise, I just realized that I wasn't being active enough, and I had discovered all the amazing neurotransmitters that are created by exercising. And again, you get them for free. You go and you exercise. It doesn't matter how rigorous or how long the exercise is, and it doesn't matter how much you can, what your physical capability is. As long as you're moving some part of your body for an extended period of time, and sort of getting yourself a little bit tired or a little bit out of breath, what you're doing is creating dopamine, you're supporting serotonin, and all these feel-good chemicals that you get into the brain. And I know that I need those to help me with my recovery. And all the package together then comes into this beautiful ball of like free things that we can get that causes us to have a better brain recovery. It heals the brain better. And we can do that in line with and while we are involved with doctors, medications, and all that kind of stuff. It happens together. It's not one thing or the other.
Right. So you're a big advocate of the ways in which we use language, the people we surround ourselves with, the lifestyle we lead, so sleep, food, nutrition, exercise, etc., and the use of words, like I said, language, like the power of the word yet, and this whole notion of post-traumatic growth. And I know it's also really important to you that you really believe in the concept of following your heart. And what have you learned about that in the course of this recovery from the stroke and the brain surgery and everything you've learned about yourself and about the world around you and your place in it?
Well, the guy before stroke doesn't have a podcast, isn't on the Nurse Keith show, has never coached anybody for anything. The guy before stroke's angry and upset and has problems that he can't solve. It's such a terrible, boring version of what life could be. And then following my heart, what that did is it's the exact opposite of that. So all of the things that I'm doing are all heart-based now. So when I do the podcast, it's a heart-based task that I've set out to do. And why? Because I was missing connection with people and my world was too small. It was too narrow. It was all about work. So now my world is about doing things that I love. And that's what following your heart means. It doesn't mean that you just do what your heart says and you don't put any thought into it. You do put some thought into it. And the thought is about how can I do what my heart desires in a way that's going to be supportive for me and it's going to bring me joy and happiness without it causing another burden like I can't afford to do that. For example, I can't afford to take a world trip. My heart would deeply love me to do that. But my heart can allow me to go interstate for 2 to 5 days and get a similar experience. And my head is also saying, but well, you can also afford that too, and that's going to be great. So following my heart means that I do what I would like to desire, what I'd like to see out of life, what I'd like to experience. And the podcast is exactly one of those things. And what that's done is that's got me to a point where at some point around episode 100 or something, I said, I think stroke's the best thing that happened to me. And when I dove deeper into that, what I realized was that was where the post-traumatic growth was happening, but also I had found my purpose, and my purpose sort of emerged by chance, not that I was seeking it out, emerged when I started doing things for other people and started sharing what was working for me. And this is working for you. Maybe I can decrease the time that you take to get to a great stroke recovery by sharing what I have already learned. And then I found myself saying, look, I think I've reached my life's purpose. Like, I know what my life is meant to be about now. It's about helping other people overcome adversity, find solutions to problems, heal quickly, emotionally, physically, mentally, and be a better version of themselves and be an amazing example to the people around them about how you deal with adversity.
Well said. Wow. That's a mic drop. I've ever heard one. Great answer. So if I'm listening to the show and I'm a nurse and either I've had a stroke, family members had a stroke, or I work with stroke patients in my job as a nurse, as a healthcare professional, and if I or someone I send go over to recoveryafterstroke.com to your website, what do we find in terms of, well, there's the podcast, of course. We can find it there, and it's also on Apple and all the podcast apps. But what do we find in terms of the coaching that you provide one-to-one? And also, what about your stroke recovery community? What can people expect, and what can we tell our patients about what they might expect from that?
So what you can find if you're a family member who's listening to this is you can find an ebook that people can download. It's called 7 Questions to Ask Your Doctor About Your Stroke. Mm-hmm. It's the best because it arms you with some questions that are going to start a conversation that most people who haven't had a stroke wouldn't know to start. For example, where did the stroke happen and what part of my brain has that affected and what does that part of the brain do? And then from there, we're off. The conversation can go wherever they want. There is a couple of basic short courses that people can buy as cheap as a dollar, and the most expensive one is $49, and get a little bit of information from my perspective about the things that they need to attend to for recovery. The coaching one-on-one, they can reach out to me and we can discuss about whether or not I can go through that process with them and support them. Will what I offer be useful to them? Is it worth going down that path? And the coaching is very informal. We get together over Zoom and we talk to people about how they're feeling, what they need to do, for example, what conversation to have with the doctor, whether they need to seek out another therapist. So I just try and be like the person who has information and sets them on new paths of discovery. And then we reconvene and then we kind of have a bit of an understanding of what happened the month before, the week before, and then we send them out on another task, so to speak, to complete. And it's all about just trying to empower them with tools and resources. And as far as the community goes, it seems that the community has really taken hold at instagram.com/recoveryafterstroke. And what happens there is the most amazing thing because I've got about 5,500 stroke survivors that follow me. And in my coaching, every once in a while, some stroke survivor will ask me a strange question like, how come I can hear strange voices in my right ear after the stroke? And it's like, I don't know. I've never heard that before. So I'll put it out to the community. Does anyone else who's had a stroke experience noises, sounds, or voices in one ear after the stroke? And you wouldn't believe it. Mm. They say, yep, that's me. I can relate to that. That happened to me. Mm. And so on. So we get these weird and wonderful questions that come through all these different avenues. I put it to the stroke community and those guys reveal that it's normal, that it happens to them. And what that does is make everyone else feel like, wow, it's not just me. I'm not on my own. There's other people who understand what I'm going through.
And that's really what community is all about. And that's sort of that, for me, that concept of collective genius, you know, like
indeed.
your network, your group, your community, your family, whatever it happens to be for you, it's collective genius when you put all of those minds together and to support one another and share resources and stories. And that's very important. And, you know, this brings to mind my mom. She died at 78 of a massive hemorrhagic stroke. She had a platelet disorder and they were trying to control it. And she was a concert pianist and she'd been a professional since she was age 4. And I'll tell this story really briefly, that she was giving a recital with her students and she was not quite up to par that day. And she was repeating herself. She was at the piano. And at a certain point, my sister, who was in the audience, noticed that my mom was madly playing the piano with one hand. So she was trying to play the bass notes and the melody at the same time because she was a Juilliard trained pianist and her left arm was hanging down at the side of her body. And for her, she was brain dead within, I think, 30 minutes once they got her into the ambulance. And, you know, I think about her hearing your story and reading your book and someone like my mom who was so, identified with being a pianist. I mean, that was her entire life since she was 4 years old as a professional, that I wonder what would have happened with my mom if she had lived and had lost so much capacity. So I'm sure there's people out there for whom that loss is really devastating. And I'm sure you run into people who have a real hard time with it, don't you?
I do. Mm. Now, a lot of my survivors are musicians, and one particular gentleman who had a stroke, Antonio Iannella in Melbourne, is a friend of mine now. So he was a guitarist and he was in a band, and he was, as a result of his stroke, left in a situation where he can't use one side of his body and therefore he can't play guitar anymore. Mm. As a result, he transitioned to piano because he can play one-handed, and he's become a producer.
Interesting.
So his identity was so wrapped up in music that he couldn't see himself not being involved in music, but he needed to evolve the identity a little bit beyond, I'm just a guitarist. And he went from a guitarist to now, I believe, being an actual musician because he's across the entire spectrum of music. He's playing it and he's producing it and he's getting involved with lyrics and he's getting involved with writing music. And now he's still able to participate and not miss out on his identity that was such an important part of his life. And he's going to be the guy that's going to help me with your audiobook. Isn't that fantastic?
Interesting. Wow. I love that story. I'm glad we went down that little path with the story about my mom. And, you know, I don't want to go and we have to wind down. And I just wanted to ask you, you know, how many years has it been since your strokes and your surgery? And what deficits do you feel like you're still working with at this juncture?
First bleed was in February 2012. Second bleed was in March 2012. Third bleed was in November 2014. Brain surgery was in November 2014. So this year will be 10 years since brain surgery and 12 years since I started down this journey. And it's one of the things that is important to share because people who come across the podcast and see me being myself through the screen and listening on the audio think that they need to get to where I am, and they perhaps think that I got there very quickly, but it didn't. It took a long time for me to be well enough to be able to do consistent podcast episodes to get back into my life. In fact, I went back to proper full-time work in 2019, so it took me 7 years to get to full-time proper work. And I want to tell people that that they shouldn't put a timeline on their recovery or deadlines or anything like that. They should just have a goal and just work towards it, celebrate the wins, and then focus on the possibilities rather than what you've lost.
Mm. Yeah. And that says a lot about the ways in which emotional intelligence and your whole recovery mindset have become kind of the axis around which you revolve. you know, in your work, in your life, in your own recovery, and working with the people who you help all over the world. And before we go, and we could talk for much longer, I'm sure, but I have four quick questions I like to ask all my guests, and it's not really directly related to what we've been talking about. Are you up for a little lightning round?
Indeed.
Sure. Okay. So the first question is, how would you define success, either personally or professionally? What does that mean to you?
I think success means for me that you build the right community around you, including your family, direct and indirect. And then people also out of that direct and indirect family that includes friends and associates, et cetera, that are the type of people that support you to be the best that you can be. You hang around with those kind of people. And that when you have that type of support, that type of foundation, that then once you've built that, you will find that you cannot not do amazing things in your life because the people are encouraging you to do that kind of stuff. So I feel like I'm successful now because the lady at the cafe down the road from my house says, when are we going to do the book launch at the cafe? When can we do the book launch at the cafe? And can you please bring me posters so I can promote your book? I think that's success because before what I had to do was I used to knock on people's doors and say, can I please paint your house? I'll give you the cheapest price. I'll give you the best, you know, I'll work the hardest. I'll work the longest. And it's such a different experience because both of them are offering a service, but this particular service, people are knocking on my door for it rather than the other way around. And I think that's success.
That's wonderful. I love that. That's really a great illustration. Okay. Second question. Could you name or describe a person who's inspired you in the course of your life? They could be living or dead, can be a very famous person who you admire, or someone from your personal life who none of us would know.
I couldn't name one person, but in my reflections, when I was writing the book, I kind of did a very small history of my family. And I realized that my parents, my mum and dad, both came from a generation that was born just after the Second World War, whose parents had experienced the First World War and the Second World War, and then whose parents before them were living in the first free Greek Republic after 400 years of Ottoman rule. Hmm. So when I'm thinking about people who I am inspired by, I'm inspired by all the people who came before me in my family who somehow found a way in the most trying circumstances to provide for the family, create safety, create the next generation, encourage people as best as they could with the resources they had to do the best that they could be. And then when I think about what that led to my parents making the most bravest decision that two people can make. So they left their homeland, they came to Australia, to a land that they couldn't speak the language in with nothing. And they created this amazing opportunity for me and my brother and now our kids. So, you know, it's my extended family who I think about when you ask that question. But then the two people that require the most credit are my parents for sure, because they were the example that I had. And now I have the platform and the opportunity to set the example for the next generation.
I love that. That's beautiful. And I bet your kids will say the same thing about you someday. So, third question, is there a book or a movie, not necessarily your absolute favorite, because that's hard for many of us to say, but just a book or movie that holds meaning for you, that's impacted the way you think, the way you live, the way you conduct yourself in your relationships, anything at all that you'd want to share?
There's one that's related to stroke recovery. The first book I read about stroke recovery was a book called, it was by Dr. David Perlmutter. It was Grain Brain. Hmm. And that book, Grain Brain, just changed my mind and my understanding about how much of a negative impact we can have on our own brains. So whether you're a stroke survivor or not, you can have a negative impact on your brain. And I think if our brain's not working optimally, then the rest of us is definitely being impacted by the same decisions that we're making that are decreasing our brain's capacity to operate optimally. And then on a personal note, recently I read a book by Ryan Holiday called The Obstacle is the Way. And it's such a great book that you don't even have to read past the title for me. The Obstacle is the Way basically means to me that when I got to the obstacle, I know I'm in the right place. That's the thing I've got to learn to overcome. That's the thing I've got to get around. That's the thing I've got to tunnel under. No matter what, that obstacle is there as a resource to say to me, okay, you've got to level up now. You've got to learn. You've got to be better than you were, and you've got to find a way through, over, around, or under. So The Obstacle is the Way by Ryan Holiday. It's based on Stoicism and the philosophy that was made famous by the Stoics 2,000 years ago, my ancestors, the ancient Greeks. And yeah, they're the two books.
That's great. That's great. That's really good ones. Thank you so much. Okay, last question. If you, Bill, were named king of the world tomorrow and you had absolute power, what would be one of the first things you'd want to do to improve the lives of your subjects?
Free healthcare for everybody.
Perfect. Many guests have said that. I wonder why. I wonder why.
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense, isn't it? If we don't look after the people, if we don't look after the people, we haven't done anything in life, really, if we're not looking after each other.
Exactly.
We really haven't done anything.
Yeah. Well, Bill, thank you so much. This has been so wonderful. I encourage people to go to recoveryafterstroke.com. They can check out the community on Instagram, which is Recovery After Stroke. We'll have all the links in the show notes. And I want them to check out the podcast, the Recovery After Stroke podcast. And the book, of course, we'll have a link to the book in the show notes, The Unexpected Way That a Stroke Became the Best Thing That Happened by Bill Gassiamus. So Bill, thank you so much. This has been really wonderful. And you're really an inspiration in the greatest sense of the word.
Thanks, Keith. I really appreciate the opportunity. I love the work that you're doing as well. Speaking directly to nurses about things that can help them be better nurses, better individuals, and hopefully healthier and, you know, better able to navigate their own life and have good life balance. What an amazing, amazing service.
Thank you so much. Well, there you have it. Thanks for listening to this awesome episode of the Nurse Keith Show. Remember, the show notes will be found at nursekeith.com. Please go to recoveryafterstroke.com to check out the community and check out the book and the podcast. If you need personalized holistic career coaching to elevate your nursing career, check out Nurse Keith Coaching at nursekeith.com. Mention the show and get 10% off your first coaching package. We are proud members of the Health Podcast Network at healthpodcastnetwork.com. And we are jointly produced by Rob Johnston of 520R Podcasting. And before we say goodbye, I'll leave you with this quote that I think Bill will really appreciate based on what he shared. May my living honor my parents. May my living repay the debt of my existence. That's by the musician Robert Fripp. Be well, dig deep, seek joy, keep in touch. This is Nurse Keith saying adios till next time from beautiful Santa Fe, New Mexico, and the inimitable, wonderful Bill Gassiamus saying yasu from
Melbourne, Australia.
All right. Thank you, Bill. Thanks to everyone for listening, and we will catch you on the proverbial flip side.